Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the election of a far-right former army captain as the next president of Brazil, the world's fourth largest democracy. James Green, professor of modern Latin American history and Portuguese and Brazilian studies, as well as a director of the Brazil Initiative at Brown University, joins us to discuss the alarming facts about who the clear winner of Sunday's election, Jair Bolsonaro, is, what he believes, and what he has said. Having insulted women, gays, and Brazil's majority of citizens of African descent, Bolsonaro has given clear indications that he will remove restraints stopping the farming and mining lobby from cutting down more of Brazil's rainforests, often referred to as the lungs of the earth. He has also threatened to remove protections which indigenous peoples have been given to save their rainforests and ancestral lands. We'll also discuss why left-of-center parties that have ruled for decades in France, Italy, and Germany, like the Workers' Party in Brazil, have dramatically lost ground to right-wing populism. And we will assess what role the military might have in Bolsonaro's Brazil, given the likelihood that they will play a dominant role in the future, which many fear could augur a return of right-wing military dictatorship. Then we'll speak with Rui Teixeira, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, whose latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think, about his article at The Guardian, Democrats Hope Latino Voters Will Help Them Win. Don't count on it. With over 90% of the eligible Latino voters concentrated in 10 states and 56% living in California, Texas, and Florida, we will discuss polls that indicate the Democrats are underperforming with Latino voters, 55% of whom have not been contacted in any way about the upcoming election. Meanwhile, Republicans in California and Texas, including Ted Cruz, who is drawing 37% of the Latino vote in spite of the impressive challenge by Beto O'Rourke, are not behind Democrats by a wide margin. Then finally, with 5,200 troops heading for the southern border in the Trump administration's Operation Faithful Patriot, we will speak with Ryan Devereaux, an award-winning investigative journalist covering immigration enforcement, the drug war, and national security, for The Intercept, where he has an article, How the Trump Administration is Manufacturing a New Border Crisis. He joins us to discuss the drumbeat of organized hysteria Fox News and the right-wing echo chamber are ginning up, orchestrated by Fox's Bill Shine at the White House, to make the caravan of migrants from Central America seem like an apocalyptic alien invasion. And joining us now is James Green, the Carlos Manuel de Cespedes Professor of Modern Latin American History and Portuguese and Brazilian Studies, as well as the Director of the Brazil Institute at Brown University. He has traveled extensively throughout Latin America and lived 8 years in Brazil. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Green.
Pleasure to be here.
So, James, obviously there's a great deal of concern about Bolsonaro's election. He won fairly handily. People are celebrating the so-called legend, the legend, as he's called, for whatever reason. I'm not sure. Maybe you can fill us in on that. But there's also a great deal of concern that he's going to reverse efforts to stop the cutting down of the rainforests in Brazil, the lungs of the earth, and take away the protection that the indigenous tribes have to prevent their rainforest being cut down and turned into soybean farms. And apparently Bolsonaro's are definitely close to the farming lobby in Brazil. So let's start with the global dimension here. Is he going to reverse efforts to protect Brazil's rainforests?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to see that Bolsonaro represents a worldwide trend for far-right governments to come to power and carry out very retrograde programs in an authoritarian way. And so looking at the Amazon rainforest and the Atlantic rainforest, clearly one of his very openly stated objectives is to eliminate the restrictions on foresting, deforestation, and encouraging cattle and soybean production in sugarcane production in these areas. He probably will be withdrawing from the Paris Agreement as well. I think he's going to be finding himself very much in tune with many of Donald Trump's policies, which will include deregulation of environmental protections in Brazil. In addition to that, there's been a long struggle since the end of the dictatorship in the early 1980s And embedded in the Constitution of Brazil of 1988, a protection and the demarcation of indigenous peoples' lands, which have been encroached upon by agribusiness and small farmers. And he has very clearly stated that he wants to eliminate the protection of indigenous peoples' lands in Brazil.
So what's then, you mentioned he's a part of a far-right trend, and I suppose conversely, in terms of the Workers' Party, you could make the case that not only are far-right parties rising throughout Western Europe and around the world and here in the United States and under Trump, also these traditional parties, particularly the socialist parties that dominated French and Italian and German politics for so long, they've gotten sclerotic, have they not? And is that, did that happen to the PT?
So what's interesting here is that whereas traditionally the electoral campaigns since the return to democracy have been basically a fight between the left, as represented by the Workers' Party, although there are other political parties that are smaller than the Workers' Party that form part of that coalition in elections, and what we would call the center-right or the traditional conservative social democratic parties or Christian democratic parties in the European model or moderate Republicans, perhaps. What happened in this election was that a far-right candidate, an outsider using the discourse of anti-corruption, anti-PT, claiming that the Workers' Party, the PT, was far leftist and too radical, came into power. What's interesting is that Haddad got 45% of the votes, 47 million. In fact, he increased the votes by 1.5 million that Dilma Rousseff got in 2014, although Bolsonaro won by a 10 million vote margin. In 55%. The Workers' Party's delegation in the lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, is actually the largest bloc. And if you sum their numbers with the numbers of a group called the Party for Socialism and Liberty, PSOL, the two together form approximately the same number of seats that they had in the previous election. And so, whereas the traditional center-right political parties were massacred in the election, they really dropped considerably. They almost lost half of their seats in the Congress in the throw-the-bums-out sentiment. The Workers' Party and the left of the Workers' Party maintained its position in Congress in the lower house. And so I think that we can't say that the left has been defeated historically here, although it certainly was weakened and losing state power.
So what was all of this kind of sexual innuendo and homophobia that went on against the PT and the rhetoric of male grievance, which, of course, is very much a part of Trump's tactics in riling up the white working class and keeping them as a part of his base? You know, and they were campaigning, Bolsonaro's people, saying that the PT is trying to make our babies gay.
Right.
And
so,
they gave schools penis-shaped bottles to make them gay, et cetera. I mean, what's all that coming from?
Yeah, so this is a very complex question to answer. I'll see if I can do it succinctly. The gay rights movement emerged in 1978 in Brazil during the dictatorship. I happened to have been a founder of that movement when I lived in Brazil and kind of a leader of the left wing. And it took a long time to first win an alliance with other sectors in the left to kind of embrace LGBT rights. This is a process that took place in the late 90s into the 2000s. And the movement has grown considerably since then and has found, in general, its allies have been on the center-left as opposed to the center-right. At one point in a campaign to fight against homophobia in the school system, a curricular material was developed, which then was called the Gay Kit, allegedly teaching young people about homosexuality or to become homosexuals. And that educational material was never actually implemented. There was a pushback by evangelical Christians, and so the Ministry of Education withdrew it. But people used this event that occurred to claim that the left is trying to convert people into homosexuals and have published on the internet a series of false postings that make these allegations. And so they really kind of fed into conservative Catholic or evangelical Christian ideas about homosexuality and a lot of fake information to rev up anxiety and fear. The LGBT movement is extremely large. The parades in São Paulo are the largest in the world. And I think also the visibility, the audacity, the pride, the comfortableness that people have with their sexuality is also extremely threatening to conservative forces in Brazil. So whereas Brazil has always been thought of as this country of carnival and sexual licentiousness and openings, as I wrote many years ago in a book called Beyond Carnival, actually the society is deeply homophobic and conservative, and evangelical Christians have grown significantly in recent years that have fueled that conservative tendency. So Bolsonaro played on that to get support among evangelical Christians who are receiving fake news or false information on their cell phones through WhatsApp, an application that's very popular in Brazil, and that therefore kind of distorted people's understanding of the program of the Workers' Party, which clearly defends LGBT rights.
And again, I'm speaking with James Green, who's the Carlos Manuel de Cespedes Professor of Modern Latin American History and Portuguese and Brazilian Studies, as well as the Director of the Brazil Initiative at Brown University. And he's traveled extensively throughout Latin America and lived 8 years in Brazil. And of course, Bolsonaro is a Catholic who converted to evangelical Christianity, did he not?
He does, and he uses the language of religion in all of his discussions. He prayed before he gave his acceptance speech. He uses the language of God above all as part of his rhetorical campaign rhetoric, and he is very much influenced and supported by conservative evangelical Christians, although during the electoral campaign, more mainstream Christian organizations, Protestant and in the Catholic Church, came out very clearly against Bolsonaro and the kind of hatred and the anger and the hostility he has towards not just LGBT people, but also against women, against people of color, against Brazil's large Afro-Brazilian population. And he's made very recent explicit comments in all of these fronts that have really show his true colors.
Well, let me just give our audience a flavor of his true colors. These are some quotes from Bolsonaro, the new leader of Brazil. Pinochet should have killed more people. I have five daughters. Four were boys. On the fifth, I got weak and had a daughter. Let's shoot all the PT members. I'm favorable to torture, and you know this. The situation in the country would be better today if the dictatorship had killed more people. I never beat my ex-wife, but I thought of shooting her various times. And I would be unable to love a gay son. I won't be hypocritical here. I would prefer that my son die in an accident rather than appear with a gay moustache. For me, he would be dead. So that's just some of a flavor.
And some of these are statements he's made many years ago. Others he made recently, right, when former President Dilma Rousseff was impeached in the lower house of the Congress. When he voted, his declaration of vote honored one of the most infamous torturers in Brazil, a man named Colonel Ustra, and he dedicated his vote to the military takeover in 1964. So these are not just language from his far past, but these are things that he consistently and recently have stated to express his true ideas. So some people question whether this was just campaign rhetoric and whether he'll change when he's in office. And I think if we look at examples such as Donald Trump, he had campaign rhetoric and then he didn't change when he came to office. And the only issue will be whether there will be strong resistance and oppositional movements and political leaders who will push back and fight against his most nefarious measures that he intends to try to carry out and get approved by Congress and implemented in Brazil.
So as horrible as this sounds, and I mean, Brazil metaphorically, of course, suffered a massive insult and loss with the burning down of the National Museum. So there's an indication that the country was not in great shape and was in some kind of doldrums, if you will. And of course, with a high crime rate, somebody that promises law and order, obviously, that would resonate. So what can constrain this terrible man? I mean, he makes Donald Trump look kind of reasonable, doesn't he?
I would agree with that assessment. I think there'll be two ways. I think one of them will be after people get over the shock of his victory and rethink what that means in terms of their day-to-day lives, that there will be a series of measures that will be implemented or proposed by the new government, which will spark tremendous opposition and will mobilize people. Because Brazil, through the process of fighting against the dictatorship in the 1970s into the 80s and establishing democracy and consolidating democracy and building movements for social inclusion, has developed a strong tradition of mobilization and opposition. And I think that if those who voted against Bolsonaro voted for the Workers' Party, some people actually did not vote for the Workers' Party, but voted for the candidate merely to oppose Bolsonaro. If a very strong, broad democratic front can be constructed among politicians, and if social movements can find ways to build unity and strength, I think he's going to face significant public opposition and pushback, and making it harder to implement his program. Now, this runs a risk, and I'm not suggesting that this not happen, but the risk, of course, is that if there's tremendous social polarization, and he likely would respond to massive mobilizations by repression, which can usually escalate mobilization and then violence, then there is the possibility, it's somewhat remote at this point, but it's possible that the military might intervene again. Bolsonaro has promised to include in his cabinet a series of generals. It's really the first time that a number of generals have been in any cabinet since the return to democracy. And so he might not need to actually call the army in to take power. He might create a government which, in fact, de facto the military is running through its generals who are controlling key ministries. And he has promised to criminalize the landless peasants movement, which is very famous internationally, declaring that it's a terrorist organization. There's a very important homeless people's movement in the cities that he also has threatened to consider a terrorist organization. So if he's able to implement these measures, some of which actually exist in the Constitution that he can draw upon, then I think there could be a serious polarization that could even lead to the military coming to power full force.
What about the possibility of a civil war? There's a lot of guns out there, aren't there? And already there's some been some.
I think that the left in the 1970s understood, and there are many veterans of that period, people who took up arms against the military regime in 68, 69 through 74. I think they understood and will be wise counselors to say that it would be very, very difficult for a civilian movement to outnumber, outarm, outshoot, be victorious against the military and the army. And so I'm assuming and I'm hoping that there won't be this path taken. I think that it's much more likely that there will be a very broad democratic movement. Even the presidential candidate, Fernando Haddad, a lawyer and a university professor, called on people to build the opposition for a contest in 4 years in the next presidential election. Now, Bolsonaro has promised that he's going to pass a law where he cannot be reelected. This was the tradition until a former president, Cardoso, changed the law in order to be reelected, and that's been the tradition in the last 20 years. But Bolsonaro has promised, I don't know if he's going to carry through with this promise, to eliminate reelection, which also then opens much more the door for perhaps Haddad being a candidate in 4 years or some other person representing the left challenging the right. We'll see.
Right.
I think the violence is going to come from the state, and there will be certain students and others who might carry out actions of breaking windows and vandalizing stores. But I think that that's not the sentiment of the large number of people that have been mobilized, and I hope that continues to be the case.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, James Green, we started out talking about Bolsonaro reversing efforts to deal with climate change, particularly Brazil being the lungs of the earth and the farming lobby, which is close to allowing more and more rainforest to be cut down and the protections that the indigenous tribes have being taken away to preserve and protect their own forests. So, but if Bolsonaro pulls out of the Paris Accords, I think there'll be a reaction, and maybe the Europeans could start imposing tariffs or cutting imports from Brazil. So do you think that governments around the world can put some constraints on him if the Brazilian people can't?
Well, I think What is going to be required is a concerted effort by democratic forces within Brazil to organize consistent opposition to his policies in coordination with international NGOs and other forces that are in governments that are very concerned about this issue and many other issues. So it's not just the Amazon rainforest, it's the rights of Afro-descendant Brazilians who form the majority of the population, or women and women's movement, which was extremely large, feminist organized on September 29th, the largest women's demonstration in Latin America, a huge demonstration that was initiated by feminist movements against Bolsonaro. And I think the LGBT movement also is another important movement. I think this is going to require supporting and organizing and building in Brazil by Brazilians of oppositional movements in conjunction with people abroad who are friends of Brazil, who believe in democracy in Brazil, will support that. And if I may, in fact, academics and activists circulated a petition a week before the elections where 1,400 academics and students signed an opposition to Bolsonaro in 38 states and 200 colleges and universities across the United States. And now those leaders are organizing a national meeting in New York on December 1st to think of ways in which Friends of Brazil can help their allies in Brazil defend democracy in the country.
Well, James Green, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with James Green, who's the Carlos Manuel Cespedes Professor of Modern Latin American History and Portuguese and Brazilian Studies, as well as the Director of the Brazil Initiative at Brown University. He has traveled extensively throughout Latin America and has lived 8 years in Brazil. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether the Democrats can count on Latino voters to help them win in a week from now.
Tiene esperanza, aunque te esperará. Mi corazón se lanza, un fantasma corporeal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Rui Teixeira, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author or co-author of several books on American politics, including The Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judas. His latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. And he has an article at The Guardian, Democrats Hope Latino Voters Will Help Them Win. Don't Count on It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rui Teixeira.
Glad to be here.
So, Rui, the subtitle to your article is Hispanic voters are not a magic elixir for the Democratic Party. They need to be inspired to get to the polls first.
Mm-hmm.
I would say to that, well, what more does it take? I mean, you have a president who on the first day announcing his run for presidency said the Latinos and the Mexicans were a bunch of rapists and murderers. And more recently, he's been ripping Latino children from the arms of their parents. So it does seem that at a very basic level, Trump is really in your face to Hispanics with the most racist insults. And now he's demagoguing like crazy, this caravan heading north from Central America, as though the Martians are coming, the aliens, the God knows what.
He's a bit over the top, isn't he?
Yeah. So I guess that's my question. So what's your answer?
Right. Well, I think there are several kind of relevant points here. One is that despite the raw tinder you would think was there for the Democrats, for some of the reasons you were alluding to, Democrats still aren't that great in terms of outreach to Latino voters. Latino Decisions, which is probably the leading polling firm that specializes in Latino public opinion, has found over the course of this campaign that it's still the case today, or very recently in the last poll, that 55% of Latinos have never heard from anyone connected with any campaign in any way. Okay, I mean, I'm not talking about just, you know, having their door be knocked on. I'm talking about anything in the mail or a phone call or whatever. So there's still, you know, not as high a level of outreach as you would think there might be, given that this is a group that, you know, on average is 2-1 Democratic, and we have a president in the White House who seems fairly hostile to them. The second thing I think is very relevant is we shouldn't think of Latinos as just a voter group that's motivated by immigration issues or issues around, you know, how they're viewed in race-ethnic terms or whatever. This is a group that leans toward the Democrats to a large extent because they're so left on economic issues and on the role of government, and they see the government as being able to provide useful help for them in terms of social services, education, and general upward mobility. And it's not enough, apparently, for the opponent, in this case, the Republican Party, to be associated with a guy like Trump to get these voters to come out and vote at levels equivalent to whites and blacks. It doesn't appear to be enough. They have other concerns, and it may be may take a while to win them over to this. I mean, we have to remember that Latinos are a relatively low turnout group, and just in general. I mean, if you look at the last midterm election, their turnout was 27% of those who were eligible to vote. That's very low and way below whites and blacks. So this isn't to say we won't see higher Latino turnout in this election than last midterm election. I think we will. I just don't think we'll see the huge upsurge that some people may be anticipating.
And the last midterm in 2014, as you mentioned, meager 27% Latinos showed up compared with 46% amongst white Americans and 41% among black Americans. And, of course, you have to add to that that there are 12 million voting-age Hispanics in this country who can't vote because they aren't citizens. But still,
yes,
those mm-hmm. that can vote are just the distribution of the Hispanic vote in this country. They're mostly concentrated, as you say in your article, in 10 states: California, Texas, Florida, New York, Arizona, Illinois, New Jersey, Colorado, New Mexico, and Pennsylvania. And 56% live in the first three states that I mentioned, California, Texas, and Florida. So that is where the vote is largely concentrated. Florida, of course, is a key state. So, but things are changing in Florida, even though, as you point out in your article, that the Latino vote is not monolithic, that in Florida, the Cuban-American vote has always been very conservative. I believe it's being offset considerably by the refugees from Puerto Rico, who are obviously mad at Trump for tossing paper towels at them. That's another insult that I might add to the insults to Latinos that I mentioned at the opening of this conversation.
Yeah, no, the character of the Latino population in Florida is changing quite a bit. I mean, not only just for the reason you're alluding to, the growth of the Puerto Rican population, some of them refugees, at this point, and they all can vote. They're all eligible to vote automatically. The problem is they haven't been registering at as high a rate as, again, I think a lot of Democrats had hoped. It may take a while to integrate them into the political system. The second positive trend for the Democrats is if you look at younger generations of Cuban Americans, they tend to be significantly more liberal than the older generation. So I think you're seeing trends that over time are going to shift the Latino population in Florida more toward that and other states. But it's still the case that considered in aggregate, and particularly in southern Florida, the Latino population is much more conservative than it is in California or even a state like Texas.
So let's talk a bit about some of the information here in your article, Rui, mm-hmm. about where the polls have candidates in these key races where there is a considerable Latino constituency. First, here in California, in the 39th district out in the Riverside area, you have Republican Young Kim. She's drawing 36% of the Latino vote to Democrat Gil Cisneros. So, and he's what, 22 points?
He's 22 points ahead. He's getting 58% of the vote in the upshot. New York Times upshot poll. So a 22-point lead, which is good. I mean, it's helpful for, you know, Cisneros, but it's not a 30-point lead. It's not a 40-point lead. It's a solid lead.
And you're suggesting a 30-point lead would be what you would expect?
Yeah, it's a 2-to-1. You know, if on average Latinos are a 2-to-1 constituency, you would expect a 30-point lead on average in these districts. And you don't see that. You see some, you know, they're larger and some are smaller. And this is one of the ones that's smaller. And, you know, Latinos are very important in this district. So, you know, that's not as good as Cisneros. And that assumes, you know, this poll is accurate. We have to keep in mind these are small sample sizes and maybe the true figure isn't actually a 22-point lead. Maybe it's larger. But at least on the basis of these data, that's what we'd say. And we see this in some of these other congressional races. I also mentioned in the article, I believe, the Texas's 23rd congressional district, where Will Hurd is receiving, Republican Will Hurd is getting 38% of the vote, and the challenger, Gina Ortiz Jones, is only getting 51 for a very modest 13-point lead, far less than she probably needs. So these are just concerning signs. It means, as I say, they're not a monolith. They're not as heavily mobilized in this election as Democrats had probably hoped, and that therefore, you know, one shouldn't have unreasonable expectations of how much this is going to help push them over the line.
Well, the very visible race that's getting a lot of publicity is, of course, the Senate race in Texas, where Democrat Beto O'Rourke is raising record amounts of money, and Ted Cruz, the incumbent, is not a likable candidate, no, to say the least. And recent polls have Ted Cruz pulling 37% of the Hispanic vote to what? Where's Beto?
Depends on the poll, but Beto is more in the, you know, high 50s, perhaps, low 60s, for a 20 to 25-point lead, which, again, is good. But, you'd think that based on his politics and how he's running, he should have more like a 30-point lead. 37%, I mean, Texas Hispanics have been known to vote for Republicans at rates larger than in the rest of the country, depending on the candidate. And Cruz is managing to pull, you know, well over a third, it looks like, according to the polls that we've seen. And what, given the weaknesses O'Rourke has in the white electorate, particularly in the non-college white electorate, with looms large in Texas, to close the deal, it seriously helped him to have a 30 or 40-point lead among Latinos, because he just doesn't seem to be making that much headway among certain sectors of the white vote. So that's why one of the contributing reasons why he continues to trail Cruz in the polls and will probably lose, even though, you know, in a personal level, I'd like to see him win, but I just don't see it at this point. I mean, I just think it's improbable.
But isn't immigration one of the main issues in that election? It's pretty much the subtext for the vote against him, isn't it? They think he's too, you know, they keep saying, I mean, they're saying the most outrageous stuff, the Republicans. And obviously in this campaign is a total fact-free zone in terms of what these commercials are, whether they're Democratic or Republican commercials. They are just getting more and more nasty and detached from reality. But isn't that the subtext, that Beto's too sort of liberal and advocates open borders and Ted Cruz is going to get tough? Is that, I haven't followed the race that closely, but that's my understanding, that it's immigration.
Yeah, no, that's certainly part of it. And we should keep in mind that not only are some white voters susceptible to typecasting Democrats as people who favor open borders, there are some Latinos as well who, you know, are not necessarily for, I mean, they don't want immigrants demonized, but on the other hand, they're not necessarily for open borders. And I don't think that's what O'Rourke is saying, but that's certainly, you know, the ways they attempt to typecast them on the Republican side. So, but again, I think the fundamental issue for me or thing to focus on is that if our hypothesis is that Latinos are one-issue voters on immigration, then these are the kinds of results that would lead us to reject that hypothesis, because these are very clear contrast between Democratic and Republican candidates on the issue of immigration, and it doesn't seem to be generating 50-point leads and, you know, 20-point increases in turnout. Apparently, it's a much more complex political equation for a lot of these voters. I mean, I think on balance, the Democrats are benefiting from the immigration issue among Latinos. I'm just saying that I think there's more to it than that.
Well, George W. Bush did very well with the Latino vote. And of course, he had commercials in Spanish, you know, also Jorge Bush, etc.
Yeah, right, right.
I remember them.
We remember him well.
Yeah.
Yeah, he looks like a real Bolshevik compared to today's Republicans. So,
right, but yeah. I think he got over 40% of the vote. But then, in contrast, though, the Mormon businessman, his name escapes me at the moment, Mitt Romney.
George Romney?
No, Mitt Romney.
Oh, Mitt Romney. Yeah,
yeah,
George Romney was the first Mormon Romney.
Yeah, yeah.
How can we forget this? Mitt?
Right, well, he only got about
11. We hardly knew ye.
Right, but he only got about 11% of the Latino vote compared to George W. Bush.
Well, he got less. I mean, you don't mean he got literally 11% of the Latino vote. You mean the difference between what he got and what Bush got was probably about 11 points.
Was it? Know. Oh, okay. I thought he only got less.
No, he didn't literally get 11%. Actually, the percent of the Latino vote that Romney got and that Trump got are actually quite similar.
And what are
it's
they?
Just the Democratic percentage was lower for Hillary than for Obama.
Okay.
So the margin wasn't as big.
Right. So what? In any case, the point I wanted to make, and it's been made by others, is that the reason that Romney didn't do as well as George W. Bush with the Latino vote was that he talked about self-deportation and that affected him. So there is some evidence out there that immigration is an issue that resonates amongst Latinos.
Oh, yeah. I mean, by no means do I mean to say it does not resonate, and it has not hurt the Republicans among Latinos to have the kind of stance that they do. But there does appear to be a floor for Republican Latino support that it's hard to push them below unless you close the deal in other ways.
So what would you suggest? I know that's not your job, Rui, but what kind of I mean, first of all, people ought to start knocking on doors, right? If only, what did you say, 55% of Latinos have it?
Yeah, haven't been contacted in any way, manner, shape, or form.
By either party, right. So that would be a place to start, right?
I think the knocking on doors thing is pretty key. The data are very clear that you really enhance the likelihood of, you know, someone turning out the vote if they are contacted, and particularly if they're contacted in person. And conversely, if you have no contact with them, and it substantially reduces the likelihood they're going to show up. So that just seems like plan A. I'd say plan B is to maybe not put all your eggs in the immigration basket. I mean, that there needs to be a more direct and focused economic appeal to these voters. And that to some extent, maybe Democrats get a little lazy about this because they think, well, you know, it's so obvious. I mean, immigration, I mean, this guy's a nut. All we've got to do is, and, you know, this whole party is nuts. Yeah. So all we got to do is talk about that a lot, and that'll be enough. Maybe that isn't enough.
Well, there have been certain suspicions about this caravan coming up. Of course, Trump himself has argued that it's George Soros who financed it, which makes no sense.
Yeah, right.
Because Trump clearly appears to be benefiting, at least rousing his base. And indeed, Newt Gingrich is the one who suggested to Trump run on two issues, the caravan and Kavanaugh. And Trump seems to be taking Gingrich's advice. So there's no question that they're trying to make hay out of it. And just in this last couple of weeks, you can see how we get whipsawed by events like the serial bomber and then the murderer of the worshippers at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. So it's hard to know where we're going to be a week from tomorrow in terms of the news. The caravan's going to take a while, isn't it? I mean, up to a month, I think, to get to the north.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I understand it, they're unlikely to hit the border anytime, you know, until well after the election, even if they make it that far. So, but, you know, actually, that's probably good for them in a way because they can keep on talking about how it's coming. You know?
Right, I see.
Keep showing the pictures.
And,
I think whether or not they had anything to do with getting this started, and I'm not a big fan of conspiracy theories, my guess is this is probably a natural outgrowth of the situation in Honduras and elsewhere. But it's clearly in their interest to focus on it and promote it and show pictures. And I think they don't have another good strategy to run on at this point. And I think the party is clearly, you know, Trump is a leader, and he sets the tone, and he's talking about that, so are a lot of these other candidates going to do the same thing. They can't talk about the tax bill. They trying to cover their ass on health care. I mean, what do you run on at this point? I mean, you're running on the politics of immigration, the politics of fear, the politics of, you know, elite liberal conspiracies and what have you. And I don't, you know, that's not going to change until after this election, where if Republicans do relatively poorly, maybe that'll lead to some rethinking. But there ain't going to be no rethinking until, you know, the last vote is cast.
Well, but Trump is running on lies. I mean, he's I don't know whether you know this, Rui, but now the Republicans are going to protect pre-existing conditions, you know. And
well, right, but I just don't think that's going to be very effective. Right. I understand that they're saying it. Right. I just don't think at the margin it's going to make much difference at this point. Right. Of course they're making it up.
And middle-class tax, you know, cut? Have you heard about the middle-class tax cut?
Of course, yeah. Well, and, you know, not only in the new Medicare, you know, prescription drug prices, and, yeah, they're just, like, throwing everything against the wall to see what sticks. But, you know, I don't think, again, I think at the margin this is going to have relatively little effect, and I think they have much higher hopes for sort of the campaign of fear.
Right.
As,
well,
something that can really gin up their base rather than they're suddenly going to convince people they're, you know, completely different in terms of their social policies than they are.
Well, you are indeed the optimistic leftist, because
trademark TM, man, that's me.
I on the other hand,
you're a pessimistic leftist. I can
no,
tell.
No, I'm not. I'm more of a Mencken type. I know he was a right winger, and I'm certainly not a right winger. But the idea that nobody ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American people. So,
I hear you.
All right. Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Okay, it was fun. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Rui Teixeira, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author or co-author of several books on American politics, including The Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judas. And his latest book is The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. And he has an article at The Guardian, Democrats Hope Latino Voters Will Help Them Win. Don't Count on It. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the Trump administration is manufacturing a new border crisis as 5,200 troops head for the southern border in Operation Faithful Patriot. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ryan Devereaux, who's an award-winning investigative journalist covering immigration enforcement, the drug war, and national security for The Intercept. His work has appeared in The Guardian, RollingStone.com, The Nation, Democracy Now!, The Village Voice, and his latest article at The Intercept is How the Trump Administration is Manufacturing a New Border Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Devereaux.
Thank you for having me.
So, Ryan, apparently there's going to be about 5,200 troops deployed now. General Mattis, apparently, under pressure from Donald Trump, has agreed. The number is now higher than I thought it would be before. It's called Operation Faithful Patriot. And what are the optics going to be just before the election? Because this thing is the way that this caravan is being demagogued by Trump is clearly all about his campaign. He was advised by Newt Gingrich to campaign on two issues, Kavanaugh and the caravan. And he appears to be, at least for the moment, have dropped Kavanaugh, but he's really focusing on the caravan. So give us a picture of where you think we'll be a week from, say, today, which would be the day before the elections. What would the optics be?
Well, I think that for the administration, their optics, or at least the optics that they seem to be aiming for, is sort of what they've been going for from the very beginning since the administration came in, which is punishing immigrants in order to, you know, satisfy their base. When Trump came in as a candidate way back when, this is the first thing he started talking about. It was perceived by him and by the advisors around him that immigration and locking down the border would be a winning strategy. And so we've seen that come up again and again with Trump as president. We've seen, you know, from the very beginning with the ban on travelers from Muslim countries. We saw it with family separation over the summer. This administration has time and again returns to immigration, a particular brand of immigration enforcement with what can only be described as some political motives at the core, and that is sort of showing how tough they are by taking really extreme enforcement measures against immigrant populations. And I think in the case of this caravan, which is, you know, still, you know, nearly 1,000 miles away, what we see is the administration doing that all over again, marshaling forces, you know, actually moving military assets, serious numbers, in response to this caravan that could be weeks away, right as we're heading into the midterms. I mean, it's hard to see this as anything but a political move.
And what's the connection to the shooter or the murderer of the 11 worshippers at the synagogue in Pittsburgh in terms of, I mean, it's clear that he's aware of the caravan, but his posts were also, he blamed the Jewish Immigration Organization for bringing in people that were going to murder Americans and invaders, he called them. And the assumption was that he was talking about the caravan. But he also tweeted about Muslims being the ones that are coming in to kill us. So was it the Muslims or the Middle Easterners, to specifically what Trump hinted at, you know, in one of his dog whistles about this caravan? He said there are a bunch of Middle Easterners amongst these 5,000 to 7,000 Central Americans. So what do you think this guy was picking up on? I'm not suggesting it was the only motivation for that massacre, but there seems to be some connection there.
Well, it's difficult for me to speculate on what was going through the shooter's mind, but what I can say is that the messages that he was reflecting on right-wing social media that we've seen so far reflect a sort of deeper boiling anger that the Trump administration has capitalized on and sort of fanned the flames of. You mentioned the president's comments last week that unknown Middle Easterners, as he put it, were mixed in with this caravan of folks. I mean, this is the kind of rhetoric that we've been seeing for a while, in which the right likes to sort of paint immigrants that are moving north through Central America and Mexico as a dire national security threat. When, in fact, you know, the research shows that what we're seeing a lot of here are asylum seekers, a lot of families. Recently, data that has been produced by Department of Homeland Security on apprehensions along the border have shown that really we're in a new era than we were, let's say, 10, 15 years ago, when a lot of the folks who were crossing the border without papers were coming for work. What we're seeing now increasingly is people who are coming and looking to appeal for asylum, which is, you know, sort of an administrative path to getting into the country. And what that means is that the administration, the government, can't quickly deport them and can't detain them indefinitely. They have additional rights. This is what the administration calls loopholes. And so there's been this sort of blending on the right of this population that is coming, and this idea of this perceived threat, this wave of people from foreign countries who are coming to destroy a certain idea of what this country is all about. And I think that, you know, we've seen this administration sort of weaponize that fear to great effect, really.
Let's talk about this bizarre French racist novel translated into English in 1975, The Camp of Saints, which Steve Bannon apparently has also referenced, along with the editor of the American Conservative. What's it about, and why are they fixated on this novel, these right-wingers?
Well, essentially what the story the novel tells is about a Europe basically being under attack by waves of impoverished migrants from India. The message of the book is not personal. It's that sort of dithering among the French elite results in the downfall of white Western European society. I think that the takeaway is supposed to be that when this sort of threat arrives on your shores, you have to do something about it, and that the folks who aren't willing to do something about it are the enemy of the people. And you can understand how that sort of message has been picked up on the right for years, for generations, by the Steve Bannons of the world, and sort of recast into the current political moment that we see with migrants coming to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Well, it's pretty lurid, though, isn't it, this book? It describes thousands of wretched creatures aboard ships, run over with rivers of sperm. I mean, my God. I mean, I know it was written back in the 70s, but there are, of course, immigrants coming, risking their lives and many drowning in the Mediterranean. So it's a real issue. But is Stephen Miller also one of the followers of this kind of lurid literature?
I don't have first-hand knowledge as to whether Miller has read the book, but I do know that this book and this sort of framing of migration is widely popular in the sort of far-right circles that Miller and Bannon and those folks run in. The book, I should mention, was published, an English version of this book was published in 1975 in the United States by a publishing house called Social Contract Press. Which is sort of a white nationalist publishing house. The founder of it is also happens to be the founder of three of the sort of most influential far-right think tanks in the United States, advocating for what they would call immigration restrictions. And those organizations have close ties to the Trump administration. So what we've seen really over the last couple of years is a really far-right element of D.C. that was once considered sort of outside of the political mainstream, taking control of the levers of power, and they now have tens of thousands of armed federal agents at their disposal in the ear of the president to sort of set the tone for immigration policy. And I think that you can sort of draw a pretty clear line between that philosophy and that worldview of constant threat and danger and frankly, flat-out racism towards migrants reflected in some of the big policy decisions that this administration has made. I mean, you don't have to look any further than the separation, systematic separation of thousands of migrant children from their parents over the summer, where they're tossed into a, you know, immigration detention bureaucracy with no plans to reunite them with their family members whatsoever. I mean, that to sort of embark on a operation of that magnitude with that, those sorts of consequences for children, I think requires seeing migrants as something other than humans. And I think that's at the core of what a lot of these guys tend to think about, the people who show up to the U.S.-Mexico border seeking refuge, seeking asylum.
And what are these think tanks, these right-wing think tanks that this guy has funded that are influential now? Do you have them?
Yeah, the group's called the, you know, one is the Center for Immigration Studies, another is a group called FAIR, another is called Numbers USA. I mean, these are organizations that will, you know, flat out deny, reject the labels that the Southern Poverty Law Center sort of places on them, which is that, you know, they place them among other hate groups and sort of describe them as this nativist trifecta that is lobbying hard in Washington for the most sort of hardline restrictionist policies on immigration enforcement. And we've seen a number of folks from those think tanks sort of spread out among the Trump administration in the last couple of years, filling important roles in some of the offices and agencies that are at the forefront of directing and implementing immigration policy.
Well, it's obviously this sending 5,200 troops to the borders is very much a solution looking for a crisis, because there's so many people already on that border in terms of the Border Patrol. They have thrown so much money, and the money was being thrown at ICE during the Obama administration. Now it's been, you know, ramped up under Trump, and now you've got, along with this bloated Border Patrol, where they had to lower the standards to get people in. So basically, these are the guys that got rejected by the FBI and the Secret Service and every other police force in the country. You know, they're kind of bottom feeders in terms of law enforcement. And then on top of that, of course, you got Operation Faithful Patriot, this new deployment of 5,200 troops at the border. I mean, isn't it all meant to also, Brian, gin up support for the wall?
I mean, I think that the wall is certainly part of it. I think it's just sort of a broader extension of what you're kind of describing there, which is the buildup in our border security apparatus that's sort of accelerated over the last, I mean, depends on where you want to draw the starting line. You know, since the mid-90s and especially post-September 11th, we've seen this radical expansion. The agencies that enforce immigration law, and especially the agencies on the border, and especially the technology to sort of attempt to stop folks from coming across the border illegally. It's a remarkable sort of trajectory because, you know, during that same period of time, and particularly after the financial crash in the mid-2000s, we've seen illegal border crossings steadily decline. You know, we have been at historic lows for several years now, and yet that apparatus for controlling the border has just steadily expanded, and we just every year hear chiefs, Border Patrol chiefs and ICE saying, we need more, we need more, we need more, even though actual illegal border crossings are as low as they've been since the 70s. The only real change that we've seen is in who's crossing, and we've gone from what the government would term economic migrants to a lot of folks, like I mentioned before, who are fleeing places like El Salvador and coming to the United States seeking asylum. That's been the core change, and that is a challenge, as I mentioned, for the administration, because those folks have rights that don't allow them to be immediately deported. They're able, or supposed to be able, under U.S. and international law to make their case for asylum. And it's particularly complicated when you're talking about children being involved. And what this administration has been lobbying for since the very beginning is the authority to hold children in detention longer, potentially indefinitely, and not release them and their parents.
Well, it does seem that with those particular optics that you're talking about, which are pretty horrific, and also Trump's remarks when he first launched his campaign vilifying Mexicans as rapists and murderers, that it's pretty clear where this administration, how this administration feels about Latinos, and one only can only hope that this is reflected in a big Latino turnout in a week from tomorrow. But just in closing, Ryan Devereaux, what's your sense then of where we'll be? I know I asked you earlier about the optics, but this caravan seems to be petering out a little bit. It's going to take, look, at least another 3 weeks or so to reach the border.
Mm-hmm.
People are exhausted, and I think many are staying in Mexico. Is Trump going to be able to make this thing seem like the sky is falling and the invaders are coming if the caravan itself is petering out?
You know, it's tough to say if he'll be able to do it successfully, but I think we can count on him trying to do it. I think that this administration has demonstrated that they believe that this is a winning message. And I think that we can probably expect to see them, or, you know, holding on to this message, you know, as folks head to the polls.
Well, Ryan Devereaux, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ryan Devereaux, who's an award-winning investigative journalist covering immigration enforcement, the drug war, and national security for The Intercept. His work has also appeared in The Guardian, RollingStone.com, The Nation, Democracy Now!, and The Village Voice. And his latest article at The Intercept is How the Trump Administration is Manufacturing a New Border Crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.